Welcome to the Radio Free Space Hour on WDRT Viroqua. This is episode number 2 of Poems Aloud, a show exploring politics, history, nature, and possibilities through poetry and song. I'm your host, Ben Prostein. For this episode, as we transition out of another Midwest winter, we will be anticipating the upcoming spring holiday celebrated around the world, May Day. The long history of May Day weaves together the ecological and agrarian with labor struggles, workers' rights, and protests against the powers of capital. In the history of the United States, it has been a contested holiday since the early colonial period. May Day is accompanied by numerous poems and songs that we will read and reference to help us tell the story of this ancient celebration. We will read poems from William Blake, William Morris, Voltairine de Cleer, Kenneth Rexroth, and Allen Ginsberg, and what may be the earliest poem ever published in English in America by Thomas Morton of Marymount. The historian Peter Linebaugh, whose 2016 book, The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day, provides much of the historical context for this episode. Linebaugh refers to two histories of May Day, the green, suggesting its agrarian, pagan, and ecological origins, and the more recent red, the socialist, anarchist, and labor history, whose origins begin in the second half of the 19th century in the United States. Of course, these two histories are not entirely exclusive, and in the context of our ecological crises today, it may be necessary to weave the green and the red into a unified front against the destructive effects of our global political economy. But for now, we'll begin with the older story, what Linebaugh calls the green. The custom of celebrating the arrival of spring is an ancient one, found in all parts of the world. In Europe, it predates Christianity, and its origins may go back to at least the Neolithic period, which began about 12,000 years ago with the invention of agriculture. The custom recognizes and honors the fertility of the earth and the sustenance it provides. In Europe, this custom was celebrated in a multitude of ways. People would enter the woods to gather boughs, bark, blossoms, forming garlands, decorating their homes, and designing costumes. Bonfires were lit, music was played, games and theater were enacted, maypoles erected, brews brewed, and dances danced. The earth was churning again towards spring, the long days of light, and the people celebrated. May Day was often a day to turn things upside down. There are customs of men dressing as women, of the lowest members of society being declared kings, queens, and abbots, and the toilers of society receiving a day of rest. With the spread of Christianity in Europe, monotheism began to dominate. While Christianity no doubt suppressed or even destroyed some May Day customs, there were others it had to accept or at least transform. After the adoption of Christianity by the Roman Empire, the celebration of May Day persisted, under the auspices of a saint's day for the apostles James and Philip. So May Day became a holy day, and thus a day without work. Beginning a little over a half millennia ago, we can observe the beginnings of a massive transformation in the social structure of Europe, and the beginning of the current structure of globalization we live under today. Colonization of the Americas began, the formation of the nation-state and capitalism, the transatlantic slave trade began supplying enslaved African labor to the colonies, the European peasantry began to lose the commons through acts of government and privatization, and the numerous indigenous companies and communities of the Americas lost their lands through warfare, treaties, and disease. And with the beginning of these societal transformations, we begin, too, to observe the repression of May Day by European authorities. In 1550, an act of the British Parliament demanded that maypoles be destroyed and games outlawed. In 1644, the Puritans in England abolished May Day, believing it was pagan, far too focused on the gifts of the earth and its celebration of leisure, highly offensive to their hyperactive work ethics. But we can observe how agrarians, commoners, and the working people in Europe adapted to these challenges. The sports of May were referred to as Robin Hood games. The ancient characters that were often enacted on May Day in games and theater performances became outlaws, such as the Lord of Misrule, and the King of Unreason, and the Abbot of Inobedience. Against the repression of authorities, the holy day would be preserved. May Day was already on its way to being a day associated with political struggle and challenges to illegitimate authority. The story takes an interesting turn in the early English colonization of North America. This is the story of Thomas Morton of Merrymount. Morton emigrated to New England in 1625 and settled in what is now Massachusetts. He viewed America as a paradise, and he marveled at its ecological abundance. He named his settlement Merrymount, Merry as in joyful and jolly, not the personal name. Unlike most of his Puritan neighbors, who viewed the Algonquian natives as immoral savages or an obstacle to economic expansion, Morton admired and befriended them. He referred to himself not as the governor or owner of Merrymount, but its host, further suggesting how his mindset differed from his Puritan neighbors. On May Day in 1627, Morton hosted a celebration of the holiday at Merrymount. He raised an 80-foot pine tree as a maypole, attaching buck antlers to the top and numerous ribbons. In Morton's account, it was the festival day of Philip and James, so he therefore brewed a barrel of excellent beer. The May Day celebration was attended by gay people, runaway servants, former slaves, Algonquians, and what the Puritan governor William Bradford called all the scum of the country. In Bradford's account, the maypole was a false idol, and May Day a celebration of the idleness so despised by the toiling Puritans. Bradford also accused Morton of the following, quote, "To show his poetries, he composed sundry rhymes and verses, some tending to lasciviousness, and others to the detraction and scandal of some persons, which he affixed to this idol or idol maypole." Morton's attachment of poetry to the maypole may be the first English lyrical poetry ever published in the Americas. Morton shared his May Day poem in his later book, The New English Canon. The poem, referencing various mythological, Christian, and pagan figures, isn't very good, but it does end with the following. "The fatal sister's doom none can withstand, nor Cytherea's power who points to land, with proclamation that the 1st of May at Merrymount shall be kept, holy day." The poem is a proclamation to preserve the egalitarian English customs of May Day in the Americas, pointing to the divinity of the land, embracing people from all walks of life, and celebrating leisure. In the New English Canon, Morton also shared the reveling song that was composed that day. Here is an excerpt. "About the merry maypole take a room, make green garlands, bring bottles out, and fill sweet nectar freely about. Uncover they head and fear no harm, for here's good liquor to keep it warm." With the emphasis on celebration, leisure, and inclusiveness, it is no surprise that the Puritan elites of New England opposed Morton's May Day holiday. Morton was soon arrested for selling guns to the natives and banished to a nearby island to essentially starve. But with the help of natives, he gained enough strength and returned to England by his own volition. The maypole at Merrymount was cut down, his settlement was burned, and Morton's goods were confiscated by the Puritan authorities. He would eventually publish the New English Canon, full of observations of America and numerous critiques against Puritan colonialism. The opposition between Morton's Merrymount and the Puritans of New England has been invested with historical importance by writers as varied as Nathaniel Hawthorne and William Carlos Williams. Linebaugh offers the following as conclusion on Thomas Morton and his attempted community at Merrymount. Quote, "Thomas Morton was a thorn in the side of the Boston and Plymouth Puritans. Because he had an alternate vision of Massachusetts, he was impressed by its fertility, they by its scarcity. He befriended the Indians. They shuddered at the thought. He was egalitarian. They proclaimed themselves the elect. He freed servants. They lived off them. He armed the Indians. They used arms against Indians. To Nathaniel Hawthorne, the destiny of American settlement was decided at Marymount, casting the struggle as mirth versus gloom, grisly saints versus gay sinners, green versus iron. It was the Puritans who won, and the fate of America was determined in favor of the psalm singing, Indian scalpers whose notion of the maypole was a whipping post. End quote. For all the high morality of the Puritans, they would resort to brutal violence in their wars and retaliations against Native Americans, massacring women and children and burning villages. We can already begin to observe the creation of the myth of manifest destiny when Governor Bradford would refer to the defeat of a barbarous indigenous nation by the sword of the Lord. The Puritans also turned their oppressiveness towards women such as Anne Hutchinson, who spoke out against the spiritual authority of Puritan leaders, and the Quakers, who were persecuted by Puritans through whippings, fines, banishments, and at times even execution. On the other side of the Atlantic, the suppression of May Day was part of the long transformation of English labor into the discipline of industrial wage work. While we may assume the peasants of Europe endlessly toiled in the drudgery of pre-industrial society, this is far more an assumption than a fact. The work discipline we know today has a history of being imposed, not occurring naturally through the invisible hands of economy. May Day was one of the 100-plus holy days of medieval Europe, that is, days without work. To increase the hours of labor and hence surplus and profit, the holidays were targeted and abolished. But May Day would persist beyond the Industrial Revolution, led mostly by the chimney sweepers and milkmaids of England. On May Day, chimney sweepers would dress up as women, or whiten their faces in contrast to its usual sootiness, or wear aristocratic wigs and take to the streets and sing songs. Milkmaids would wear floral garlands, dance, and convince dairy farmers to distribute their milk freely for the day. The poet and artist William Blake engraved an image of May Day in London, showing the milkmaids and chimney sweeps celebrating in the streets. Blake would return to the chimney sweeper again in his collection of poems, The Songs of Innocence and of Experience, published at the end of the 18th century. As with many poems in this collection of Blake's, there is an innocent version of the chimney sweeper and an experienced version as well. Here is the version of the chimney sweeper from the Songs of Innocence. When my mother died, I was very young, and my father sold me, while yet my tongue could scarcely cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep. There's little Tom Dacre, who cried when his head, that curled like a lamb's back, was shaved, so I said, hush, Tom. Never mind it, for when your head's bare, you know that the soot cannot spoil your white hair. And so he was quiet, and that very night, as Tom was a-sleepin', he had such a sight, that thousands of sweepers, Dick, Joe, Ned, or Jack, were all of them locked up in coffins of black. And by came an angel who had a bright key, and he opened the coffins and set them all free. Then down a green plain leaping, laughing they run, and wash in a river, and shine in the sun. Then naked and white, all their bags left behind, they rise upon clouds and sport in the wind. And the angel told Tom, if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father, and never want joy. And so Tom awoke, and we arose in the dark, and got with our bags and our brushes to work. Though the morning was cold, Tom was happy and warm. So if all do their duty, they need not fear harm. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the work of cleaning chimneys was often performed by child labor, who were sold into the line of the work by their impoverished parents. It was brutal work, and it's not a surprise that Blake would imagine Tom the chimney sweeper dreaming of a green plain and a wash in a river, far away from the wretchedness of early industrial London. The chimney sweeps would have been associated with May Day, and Blake, by invoking the green plain, brings us back to the ancient sense of the holiday. Innocence and experience are not isolated oppositions to Blake, but what he calls contraries, both necessary parts of the wholeness of life and often in tension with one another. In Blake's poems, the world of experience often imposes itself upon the world of children and innocence. In this version of The Chimney Sweeper, a child is sold into work by his father after his mother dies. The consolation for the chimney sweepers is a dream of a green, joyous world beyond the coffin of death, essentially the world of innocence and childhood that has been robbed from them. In exchange for the harsh reality of their labor, the chimney sweeper is told, if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father and never want joy. A narrative of a future heaven in exchange for the poverty and misery of the present. Now we'll hear Blake's chimney sweeper from the Songs of Experience. A little black thing among the snow, crying weep, weep, in notes of woe. Where are thy father and mother, say? They are both gone up to the church to pray. Because I was happy upon the heath and smiled among the winter's snow, they clothed me in the clothes of death and taught me to sing the notes of woe. And because I am happy and dance and sing, they think they have done me no injury and are gone to praise God and his priest and king who make up a heaven of our misery. At one point in the poem, Blake describes an image not unlike the one he engraved in the image of May Day in London, of chimney sweepers dancing and singing. But while May Day was seized by the chimney sweeps as a holiday for themselves, free from their harsh labor, for the rest of the year their misery persisted. Blake brings it back to the corruptions of political and religious authority. We can hear an echo of the Puritan view of Christianity with its focus on duty, toil, and heaven, and a rejection of worldly happiness and earthbound realities. While not directly dealing with May Day, Blake's poem The Chimney Sweeper speaks to the wider context of exploitation, worker indignation, and authority that our discussion of May Day will keep circling back to. In the London of the late 18th century, which was the world capital of empire and finance at the time, Blake rages against the hegemony of power that degrades the imagination and thus the lives of men, women, and children. It's what Blake would call in another poem, the mind forge manacles, ideas, paradigms, ways of understanding reality that imprison the imagination rather than opening up. Blake referred to the early industry of England as dark satanic mills, grinding up the joys and desires of the working class. While May Day may be buried in the wider context of Blake's chimney sweeper poems, it's a powerful coincidence that the end of his poem anticipates the future meanings of May Day. Quote, gone to praise God and his priest and king who make up a heaven of our misery. Future workers and their commemorations of May Day would not be turning their attention so much to priest and king, but to a new class of the powerful, owners of factories, corrupt judges and police, fraudulent creditors, who still make up a heaven of our misery, that is, a small few who would profit through the misery of the many. Over 100 years after Blake's poem, the songwriter and Industrial Workers of the World member Joe Hill would echo Blake in his song, The Preacher and the Slave. Here's an excerpt. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked how about something to eat, they will answer with voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land above the sky. Work and pray, live on hay, you'll get pie in the sky when you die. We can observe that May Day, prior to its modern adoption as a day of worker solidarity, has long been a point of struggle, a day to be celebrated by the oppressed and marginalized, and to elites and authorities, a day to be despised and even abolished. In the next segment, we will look at the modern origins of May Day as an international workers' holiday and the many poems that accompanied it. First, we'll hear Iowa singer-songwriter Greg Brown's musical interpretation of The Chimney Sweeper.
When my mother died, I was very young, and my father sold me while yet my tongue could scarce cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep. This little Tom Dacre, who cried when his head had curled like a lamb's back, was shaved, so I said, hush, Tom, never mind it. For when your head's bare, I know that the soot cannot spoil your white hair. So he was quiet, and that very night, as Tom was a-sleeping, he had such a sight. Thousands of sweepers, Dick, Joe, Ned, and Jack, were all of them locked up in coffins of black. By came an angel who had a bright key, and he opened the coffin, set them all free. Then down a green plain, leaping, laughing, they run, and wash in a river and shine in the sun. The naked and white, all the bags left behind, they rise upon clouds, sport in the wind. And the angel told Tom, if he'd be a good boy, he'd have God for his father and never want joy. So Tom awoke, rose in the dark, and got with our bags and our brushes to work. Though the morning was cold, Tom was happy and warm. So if all do their duty, they need not fear harm. Died. I was very young, and my father sold me while yet my tongue could scarce cry, weep, 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 weep. So your chimneys I sweep, and in soot I sleep.
Welcome back to Poems Aloud. That was Greg Brown's musical adaptation of William Blake's poem, The Chimney Sweeper. In the first segment of the show, we looked at the origins of May Day and its persistence through the social transformations of colonialism and early industrialization. Now we'll look at what historian Peter Linebaugh refers to as the red history of May Day. This brings us to Chicago in 1886, 11 years after the end of the Civil War, and 14 years after Lincoln signed the Homestead Act, giving Euro-Americans access to millions of acres of former indigenous lands on the vast prairies of the Midwest. While law and militias were necessary to dispossess natives of their land, advances in technology were necessary to turn the prairie into the fields of commodified agriculture. John Deere's invention of the steel mold barred plow in 1837 greatly assisted settlers in plowing up the finger-thick roots of the prairie. Another invention was the McCormick Reaper for the harvesting of grain. The McCormick Reaper was produced by skilled metal molders in Chicago. With the plow and the McCormick Reaper, along with the railways and the immense fertility of the prairie soils that had been stewarded by indigenous peoples for millennia, Chicago became the epicenter of trade and agricultural commodities. This is also the period that Mark Twain called the Gilded Age, a period of immense and excessive wealth captured by a tiny class of people. With the rise of the Gilded Age, we can also observe the rise of various labor and agrarian movements. In the 1871 book Democratic Vistas, the poet Walt Whitman would write, "The great word solidarity has arisen. Of all dangers to a nation, as things exist in our day, there can be no greater one than having certain portions of the people set off from the rest by a line drawn. They, not privileged as others, but degraded, humiliated, made of no account." Labor agitations were on the rise in 1886, not just in Chicago, but all over the country. On May Day, the local molders union who manufactured McCormick Reapers would join 300,000 other workers around the country who walked off their jobs, striking for the 8-hour day. These widespread strikes called not only for an 8-hour day, but rallied against the loss of work through mechanization, the exploitation of child labor, contract labor, and the convict lease system. The Knights of Labor, a 19th-century labor organization, carried the following anthem, the 8-hour song. "We want to feel the sunshine, we want to smell the flowers, we're sure God has willed it, and we mean to have 8 hours. We're summoning our forces from shipyard, shop, and mill. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will." On May Day in Chicago, 40,000 workers went on strike. By May 3rd, their numbers were up to 100,000. Outside the McCormick plant, tensions escalated between police and the demonstrators. The police opened fire, and at least 2 strikers were killed. A day later, a public meeting was called in response to outrage over the police killings. 3,000 gathered at Haymarket Square in Chicago. 2 prominent labor leaders and noted anarchists, Albert Parsons and August Spees, spoke at the gathering. The meeting was calm and no violence was advocated by the speakers. But as the public meeting closed, police rushed the demonstrators, and an unknown person threw a stick of dynamite into the crowd of police. Chaos ensued, and the police responded by opening fire. Only 1 police death was directly attributed to the dynamite. The other deaths resulted from the indiscriminate gunfire of the police. At least 7 to 8 civilians were killed and 40 were wounded. Political suppressions and persecutions of anarchists, socialists, and trade unions followed the Haymarket affair. Hundreds were arrested. Newspapers, meeting halls, and saloons were raided. The state attorney advised the police, "Make the raids first and look up the law afterwards." 8 men were charged in connection to the events at Haymarket. The trial ended up being a farce, anticipating the future trial of the anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti 40 years later. Witnesses were paid off, the jury was discriminately selected. 4 men were executed by hanging, 1 committed suicide in prison, and the other 3 were pardoned 6 years later by the governor of Illinois, who criticized the case as a mockery of justice. At his trial, Albert Parsons explained socialism and anarchism to the jury. Quote, "Briefly stated, it is the right of the toilers to the free and equal use of the tools of production, and the right of the producers to their product." He also charged the court with judicial murder, saying, quote, I am doomed by you to suffer an ignominious death because I am an outspoken enemy of coercion, of privilege, of force, of authority. Your every word and act are recorded. You are being weighed in the balance. The people are conscious of your power, your stolen power. I, a working man, stand here and to your face, in your stronghold of oppression, denounce your crimes against humanity. Before August Spies was hung, he stated, there will come a time when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you strangle today. While the Haymarket Affair initiated what some have called the first Red Scare of U.S. history, the injustice of the trial touched and inspired the next generation of radicals, organizers, and agitators in the U.S., including IWW founder Big Bill Haywood, labor organizer Mother Blore, anarchists such as Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, and Volerine de Clear, and five-time socialist presidential candidate Eugene Debs. Haymarket would be commemorated not just as an international workers' holiday on May 1st, but in many songs and poems. One of the earliest poems came from the American writer, poet, and anarchist Volerine de Clear, who, by the end of her life, would write multiple poems commemorating the martyrs of Haymarket. The fraudulent trial and execution of the Haymarket organizers politicized de Clear and moved her towards anarchism. Referring to the Haymarket trial, she would later say, "Till then, I believed in the essential justice of the American law of trial by jury. After that, I never could." The Haymarket martyrs were buried in a memorial at the Waldheim Cemetery west of Chicago. De Clear's poem, At the Grave in Waldheim, not only strives to commemorate the event, but carry on the struggles for justice. The poem, written in 1889, concludes, "And yet, ah, yet there's a rift of white, 'tis breaking over the martyr's shrine. Halt there, you doomed ones, it scathes the night, as lightning darts from its scabbard bright, and sweeps the face of the sky with light. No more shall be spilled out the blood-red wine." These are the words it is written there, keen as the lance of the northern morn. The sword of justice gleams in its glare, and the arm of justice, upraised and bare, is true to strike, aye, 'tis strong to dare. It will fall where the curse of our land is born. No more shall the necks of the nation be crushed, no more to dark tyranny's throne bend the knee, no more an objection to ground to the dust. By the brave heartbeats stilled, by the brave voices hushed, we swear that humanity yet shall be free." 8 years later, de Clear would return again to the gravesite in her poem, Light Upon Waldheim. Go forth, stand not to weep for these, till weakened with your weeping, like the snow ye melt, dissolving in a cowdered peace. Light upon Waldheim, brother, let us go. In the 20th century, the memorial at Waldheim would be returned to again in a poem by Kenneth Rexroth. While Rexroth's poetry is typically associated with California, where he lived for most of his life, Rexroth came of age in Chicago in the early 1920s. His politics were profoundly shaped by radical political movements in the early 20th century. Rexroth consciously echoes de Clear in his poem, Again at Waldheim, written around 1940. Here's how it ends. "Now in Waldheim, where the rain has fallen, careless and unthinking, for an evil century's youth. Where now the banks of dark roses lie, what memory lasts, Emma, of you, are the intrepid comrades of your grave, a pyotr of mutual aid against the iron-clad flame-throwing course of time. Your stakes were on the turn of a card whose face you knew you would not see. You knew that nothing could be more desperate than truth. And when every voice was cowed, you spoke out against the coalitions for the duration of the emergency. In the permanent emergency, you spoke for the irrefutable coalition of the blood of men." When Rexroth wrote this poem in the early 1940s, not only were the Haymarket martyrs buried at Waldheim, but also other influential radicals, including de Clear and Emma Goldman. The poem is far more elegiac than de Clear's, mourning the weakened state of revolutionary politics in the U.S. at the middle of the 20th century, as Europe and eventually the United States entered what would become the Second World War. The various radical and labor movements of the early 20th century that Rexroth himself had participated in were weakened by political and judicial persecution, censorship, and even deportations. For example, in the Red Scare following World War I, Emma Goldman was deported from the U.S. and would never return until after her death when she was buried at Waldheim. The revolutionary hope that DeClear evokes may not shine as bright in Rexroth, but despite its mournful tone, Rexroth still commemorates the spirit of the revolutionaries, working for a vision of the world they would never see, and speaking a desperate truth in the face of political and economic coalitions of power. Over half a century after the May Day riots in Chicago, Rexroth carries forth the vision of earlier generations of workers and revolutionaries, against a political and economic system that provoked what he calls a permanent emergency. Rexroth speaks for the irrefutable coalition of the blood of all, that is, a broad vision of solidarity. Through the work of organizers like Lucy Parsons, the wife of the executed Albert Parsons, May Day became not only a day to commemorate the Haymarket martyrs, but a day of international worker solidarity. Labor unions and organizations like the Knights of Labor and the AFL quickly adopted it as a holiday. The Second International adopted it as an international workers' holiday and called on all Social Democratic Party organizations and trade unions of all countries to demonstrate energetically on May 1st for the legal establishment of the 8-hour day, for the class demands of the proletariat, and for universal peace. The resolution added, "The most effective way of demonstrating on May 1st is by stoppage of work." In Mexico, May Day became known as the Day of the Chicago Martyrs, where it was celebrated for the first time in 1913. In her advocacy for establishing May Day as an international workers' holiday, Lucy Parsons would travel to England. She met with William Morris, the writer, textile designer, and socialist. In Morris's collection of political poems, Chants for Socialists, he would write two poems to commemorate May Day. Morris was no doubt working out of a more romantic English poetry tradition, and he frames his poem as a kind of call and response between the earth and the workers. Morris is remembering the older, ecologically rooted traditions of May Day that recognize the fertility and sustenance of the earth, while also incorporating the modern political movements against the exploitation of workers by capital. Here is an excerpt from Morris's poem. "The earth. O children, O toilers, what foemen beleaguer the house I've built you, the home I have won. Full great are my gifts, and my hands are all eager to fill every heart with the deeds I have done. The workers. The foemen are born of thy body, O mother, and our shape are they shapen, their voice is the same. The thought of their hearts is as ours and no other. It is they of our own house that bring us to shame. The earth. Are ye few? Are they many? What words have ye spoken to bid your own brethren remember the earth? What deeds have ye done that the bonds shall be broken and men dwell together in goodwill and mirth? The workers. They are few, we are many. And yet, O our mother, many years were we wordless and naught was our deed. But now the word flitteth from brother to brother. We have furrowed the acres and scattered the seed. The earth. Win on then, unyielding, through the fair and foul weather, and pass not a day that your deed shall avail. And in hope every spring tide, come gather together, that unto the earth ye may tell all your tale. Then this shall I promise, that I am abiding the day of your triumph, the ending of gloom, and no wealth that ye will then my hand shall be hiding, and the tears of the spring into roses shall bloom." Morris weds the two traditions of May Day together, the workers' holiday and the springtide holiday of the earth. As the older custom of May Day recognized the promise of spring and new beginnings, Morris envisions the workers gaining the future fruits of their struggle, a day of triumph where the wealth created by workers and earth will not be sequestered by the few. Morris is not only echoing the earthly English tradition of May Day, but also an older tradition of politically minded English poets. Morris is referencing the last line of Shelley's 1819 poem, The Mask of Anarchy, which was written in response to the Peterloo Massacre. It ends, "Rise like lions after slumber, an unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few." Another poem that weaves together the two traditions of May Day, albeit somewhat subtler, is a 1938 May Day poem by the American poet Louis Zukofsky. In comparison to Rexroth's elegiac poem on the trampled hopes of revolutionary movements, Zukofsky's poem has more in common with the hopeful tones of Morris and DeClear. The poem, March Comrades, was published in the leftist publication The New Masses. The New Masses was one of the most important publications for the left throughout the late 1920s and 30s, publishing a diverse set of writers including Langston Hughes, Richard Wright, Ernest Hemingway, Upton Sinclair, and Meridel Lesueur. Today, Zukofsky is typically remembered for his contribution to avant-garde and experimental poetics. Like other American poets who adhered to the revolutionary hopes in the 1930s, Zukofsky would turn away from political concerns following the rupture of World War II and the onset of the Cold War. While Zukofsky's poetry can be difficult and challenging, the following poem, March Comrades, A Chorus for Workers, is one of his more accessible. The poem directly quotes the works of Karl Marx. "Workers and farmers unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. The world is to win. This is May Day, May. Your armies are veining the earth. Railways and highways have tied blood of farmland and town, and the chains speed wheat to machine. This is May Day, May. The poor's armies veining the earth. Hires once fed by the harried cannot feed them their hire, nor can chains hold the hungry in. This is May Day, May. The poor are veining the earth. Light lights and air blossoms red like nothing on earth. Now the chains drag graves to lion. This is May Day, May. The poor's armies are veining the earth. March, comrades, in revolution, from higher unchained, till your gain be the freedom of all. The world's May Day, May. May of the freed of all the earth." May Day would eventually become an official public holiday in over 60 countries, and while its political origins can be found in the history of the labor movement in the U.S., it is not recognized by the U.S. government, and our official workers' holiday, Labor Day, occurs in September. The decision to place Labor Day in September transpired under the administration of Grover Cleveland in 1894. Labor Day was an attempt by President Cleveland to not only take attention away from the more radical May Day, but to diffuse working class anger as well. His decision occurred after he called in the National Guard to suppress the massive Pullman strike led by Eugene Debs. The violent suppression and jailing of Debs outraged many in the labor movement. While Labor Day can be understood as ceding power to labor movements, it nonetheless was an attempt to take attention away from the more radical May Day and its wider international focus. And now, today, for millions of school children, Labor Day signifies the end of the freedom of summer and the beginning of the school year. Furthermore, Labor Day weekend has been seized by retail stores to promote massive sales and discounts, and thus strengthen corporate power and profits. May Day, by contrast, is not only a day of freedom from work, but an affirmation of workers' rights and contributions, and a challenge to the power and greed of capital. The U.S. government, however, does officially commemorate the 1st of May, but is not a recognition of workers' movements, but rather the very institutions that often suppress them, law and order. Beginning in 1958, under the Cold War paranoia of the Eisenhower presidency, the U.S. government officially recognized May 1st as a law day. The codification of Law Day states, quote, "An appreciation of their liberties and the reaffirmation of their loyalty to the United States and of their rededication to the ideals of equality and justice under law and their relations with each other and with other countries, and for the cultivation of the respect for law that is so vital to the democratic way of life," end quote. We should understand Law Day as an official attempt to silence and rewrite the past. The irony is the numerous times the U.S. system of law and order has been utilized to suppress the struggle, whether that struggle was by workers, farmers, civil rights activists, immigrants, or the citizens of other countries for the ideals of equality and justice and the democratic way of life. As Walt Whitman said in a poem, no doubt echoing the spirit of May Day, "Resist much, obey little, once unquestioning obedience, once fully enslaved." The importance of May Day as a day to affirm the rights and powers of not only workers, but the oppressed and marginalized would persist throughout the 20th and 21st centuries. The lists of strikes and demonstrations and even revolutions that began or occurred on May Day is a long one that spawns every inhabited continent of the globe, from Turkey to South Africa, from Palestine to China. Despite federal attempts to hamper the holiday in the U.S., its unofficial celebration has persisted. On May Day 2006, 1.5 million people participated in May Day demonstrations to support immigrant rights, representing the largest mass protest in U.S. history. Numerous businesses closed as workers walked off the job, including meat-producing companies employing over 20,000 people. In Phoenix, protesters formed a human chain to block off Walmart and Home Depot stores. The boycott also attracted large student involvement. In Los Angeles, over 72,000 middle and high school students, about one in every four students, were absent from school. And then last year on May Day, 2018, over 100,000 people attended the workers' celebration in Turkey, despite the national state of emergency that has been in effect since 2016. The celebration commemorated their own May Day atrocities that occurred in 1977. Some chanted lines of the German poet Bertolt Brecht, "There is no salvation on your own. It's either all of us or none." We can now observe how May Day has taken on various meanings throughout history, from its original celebration of spring and the fertility of earth to a wide variety of political struggles in the modern day. What can May Day mean today? May Day is still ours for the claiming. To reclaim May Day for ourselves, we can begin remembering those who resisted and challenged the political economy of patriarchy, exploitation, and colonization that still persists today. Whether it was Thomas Morton challenging the exclusiveness of the Puritans, or the Haymarket martyrs fighting for workers' rights and the fruits of their labor, or the 1.5 million who marched for the rights of immigrants in 2006, May Day is the day to imagine new possibilities for how we could live our lives. We can also begin by not working on May Day, gathering in the public commons, sharing meals, singing songs, dancing dances, and rising up our own egalitarian maypoles. William Blake was a poet who attempted to marry contradictions, heaven and hell, innocence and experience, reason and desire. Now, more than ever, may be the time to wed together the traditions of May Day, the ecological and the economic, to tell the story of the green and the story of the red, to recognize not just the labor of humans, but also the labor of the earth. I would argue that we all need more than a day's rest, especially the ecological ecosystems that provide our sustenance. The dominant values of our economy, expansion, accumulation, extraction, profits, overproduction, tend towards ecologically destructive practices. The political economy imposed on our daily lives tends to go against both traditions of May Day. Rather than stewarding the lands and waters we depend on and respecting the rights and livelihoods of workers, it tends to degrade them. The poet Gary Snyder would revise the labor theory of value by observing that photosynthesis always creates the primary form of value, whether it's trees, grasses, plants, crops, or fossil fuels. The value humans create, whether for the purpose of subsistence or the surplus of capital, is secondary. Any real transformation of political economy will need to return dignity to all workers and all laborers, the green and the human. The last poem we'll hear today is from the American poet Allen Ginsberg. In 1965, Ginsberg would be crowned the King of May in Prague, which Ginsberg would speak to in his poem Chrál Majáles. With Ginsberg poem, we come back to the reveling and rebellious spirit of Thomas Morton's Maypole, and Ginsberg, as he does in many poems, embodies the lord of misrule and the king of unreason. He breaks social and sexual mores and turns things upside down. Ginsberg criticizes both the lying policemen and heavy industry of the Soviet Union and the napalm and money offered by the capitalists, a reference to not only the excessive wealth of the U.S., but the escalating war in Vietnam. Ginsberg wrote the poem after he was kicked out of Havana and Prague and on his way to London in an airplane. While Ginsberg's May Day poem brings us back to the early spirit of May Day, the revolutionary spirit of Haymarket and international workers' solidarity is absent. No doubt a disappointment over how state-based communism existed in the middle of the 20th century. Here's a clip of Ginsberg reading an excerpt from the poem.
For I was arrested thrice in Prague, once for singing drunk on Narodny Street, once for losing my notebooks of sex, politics, dreams, and once for having unusual sex opinions. And I was sent from Havana by plane, by detectives in green uniform. And I was sent from Prague by plane, by detectives in Czechoslovakian business suits, card players out of Cezanne, the two strange dolls that entered Joseph K.'s room at morn also entered mine and ate at my table and examined my scribbles and followed me night and morn from the houses of lovers to the cafes of Centrum. And I am the king of May, which is the power of sexual youth. And I am the king of May, which is industry in eloquence and action in amour. And I am the king of May, which is the long hair of Adam and the beard of my own body. And I am the king of May, which is Kral Majalis in the Czechoslovakian tongue. And I am the king of May, which is old human poetry, and 100,000 people chose my name. And I am the king of May, and in a few minutes I will arrive at London Airport. And I am the king of May, naturally, for I am of Slavic parentage and a Buddhist Jew who worships the sacred heart of Christ, the blue body of Krishna, the straight back of Ram, the beads of Chango, the Nigerian, singing Shiva, Shiva, in a manner which I have invented. And the king of May is a Middle European honor, mine in the 20th century, despite spaceships and the time machine, because I heard the voice of Blake in a vision and repeat that voice. And I am the king of May that sleeps with youth. And I am the king of May that I may be expelled from my kingdom with honor as of old, to show the difference between Caesar's kingdom and the kingdom of the May of man. And I am the king of May, though paranoid, for the kingdom of May is too beautiful to last for more than a month. And I am the king of May because I touched my finger to my forehead, saluting a beautiful girl with trembling hands who said, "One moment, Mr. Ginsberg," before a fat young policeman stepped between our bodies. I was going to England. And I am the king of May, returning to see Bunhill Fields and walk on Amstead Eve. And I am the king of May in a great jet plane touching Albion's shores, trembling in fear as the ship roars to a landing on the gray concrete, shakes and expels air, rolls slowly to a stop under the clouds with a part of blue heaven still visible. And though I am the king of May, the Marxist bureaucrats have beat me upon the street, kept me up all night in police stations, followed me through springtime Prague, expelled me in secret from my kingdom by jet plane. Thus I have written this poem on a jet seat in mid-heaven.
That was Allen Ginsberg reading from his May Day poem. And we'll fade out with an instrumental song from the band Godspeed You Black Emperor. The song title, Undoing a Luciferian Tower, echoes Blake's denunciation of the dark satanic mills, and perhaps it could even serve as a strange, noisy May Day march. When the band released their album Luciferian Towers in 2017, they attached the following grand demands that would certainly make a great start towards a May Day resolution. They read as follows: an end to foreign invasions, an end to borders, the total dismantling of the prison industrial complex, healthcare, housing, food, and water acknowledged as an inalienable human right, and the experts who broke this world never get to speak again.